Content warning. The following podcast contains discussion of incest and sexual assault.
You're watching Channel 37. WHXN. New Salem.
Everybody wants to be a werecat on Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show. First, spend some time with us in Stephen King's own personal cocaine emporium in Sleepwalkers. After that, opinions are had with regards to the general terribleness of all the characters in Cat People.
Hello and welcome to Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show. I'm Dan, and with me are Dave.
Hello.
Wendy.
Hi there.
And Will.
No vegetables, no dessert.
Why, that can only mean one thing.
Charles Brady is new in town.
You can actually talk to him?
Yeah, he's nice.
Real nice.
The girls all like him. The teachers all respect him.
Your teachers in Ohio must have been sorry to lose such a creative young man.
The parents all trust him.
He's utterly charming.
But nobody really knows him. Like his mother.
You cannot be in love with this girl, Charles.
You don't know me, Tanya.
But I want to.
Behind their smile is a secret.
Hi.
Come in, Tanya. I have something for you.
I don't know who you are, but I know you're not who you say you are.
Behind the secret is a hunger.
Does it have to be her?
And behind it all is the imagination of Stephen King.
Somebody help me, please!
He killed one of my men.
He was scared of a cat.
Stephen King's Sleepwalkers.
Dave, this was your week to bring us a movie. What did you have for us?
I brought us the 90s horror epic that is Sleepwalkers.
A.K.A. Stephen King's Sleepwalkers.
Stephen King's, yeah, you're quite right, yes. I forgot to add the specific branding. Yeah.
What is the reason that we should watch this in a theater?
What is the reason this got funded?
And, well, yeah, I guess it's actually probably more accurate. Okay, Dave, can you tell us what this movie's about?
I certainly can. So, Sleepwalkers is the heartwarming tale of how a cat called Clovis becomes sheriff of a small Indiana town.
Amen.
Yes, indeed.
And, but he does this by the fact that there are two, they're called sleepwalkers. They're sort of half cat demons, as played by Alice Krieger and Brian Krause from Charmed, which is his full name.
In the credits, it said starring Brian Krause. Does anything actually star Brian Krause?
And so they are these cat demons who are mother and son, but also incestuous lovers, because I guess that's what cats do. And they suck the life essence out of virginal young girls. They have just moved from their previous home where they've killed a lot of cats, because cats are the only thing that they're vulnerable to. And so they've moved into this new town. He's like going to the high school. And he's got his eye on a young lady, as played by Major Namek, who he wants to kind of be their latest kind of victim. His mother is very much sort of adamant. Like, she's kind of weak because she needs to feed, so she needs him to feed to pass it on to her. So, yeah, it's basically how Brian Krause goes on a bit of a killing spree, including his English teacher, who apparently gets very upset with him when he points out that boxes have six sides instead of four and becomes obsessed. while speeding away, he gets chased by one of the sheriff's deputies who happens to have a cat in the passenger seat called Clovis. And Clovis is very much the only adult in the room. Eventually, after trying to attack Major Namek, but getting saved by Clovis, he's seriously injured, and Alice Krieger goes on a killing spree, including Ron Perlman, who plays one of the state troopers involved. So she pretty much kills every law enforcement person in the area, but luckily Clovis is on hand to lead an army of cats to finally destroy both of these sleepwalkers. And as the film ends, it's Clovis and Major Namek waiting to start a new life together. And probably with Clovis being sheriff, because I don't think there's anybody else competent in the human being department to actually take over.
That tracks. That absolutely tracks. Thanks, Dave. So why did you pick this one?
I was introduced to this by Gillian, who had, I think she first caught it on like a late night TV showing or something.
Of course.
And so we were just chatting one day, like the subject of this film came up, and I said I'd never seen it. She went off and bought it on DVD. It was on like Amazon Marketplace for about like £1.26 or something.
Basically postage.
Yeah. And she still maintains it's the best £1.26 she's ever spent. And so she introduced it to me. I agreed with her that it was a piece of 90s cheesy insanity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it's something I've been waiting to bring to the table here for a while, just because it's, I don't think it actually takes itself that seriously. It feels like this is from Stephen King's heavy cocaine use period. And it's like, it's silly, it's dumb, but it's got a really good cast. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Alice Krieger is just, like, amazing, mm-hmm. as she is in everything. Yeah, Major Namek's pretty good. You got Ron Perlman turning up in a cameo. You've got Mark Hamill turning up in a cameo right at the start. Mm-hmm. There's a scene that's basically chock full of not just Stephen King, but a bunch of other horror directors, including kind of like Clive Barker, Toby Hooper.
You have all these great directors, and also John Landis is there.
Yeah.
And Joe Dante, who I can't believe we haven't done a Joe Dante movie yet.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. We should probably remedy that at some point.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just kind of fun. Like, it's stupid as all get out, but at the same time, it's fun in how ridiculous it is. So it's always kind of like, if we're in the mood to watch something that's, again, just sort of stupid but entertaining, yeah, mm-hmm. we'll normally throw this on. So I thought it very much fit the bill of this podcast's raison d'etre. And so I bring it before you all.
Well, thank you, Dave. Thank you very much. Will, had you seen this before, Will?
I have not.
Okay. What did you think?
Well, it's a hoot. Like, it is not a great film, but damn it, if it is not entertaining. Like, just the fact that, you know, Alice Krieger at the end just decides, okay, you know what, fuck it, I'm gonna become the Terminator. And she just goes and like fucks up the entire town. She kills the entire police department, and the only thing that stops her is an army of cats. Because apparently cats have napalm in their claws that she just blows up.
It's not that bit in the end when she picks up the state trooper's gun, fires it at a police car, and it explodes. It's like, what was that gun loaded with?
That was amazing.
Did the state troopers carry depleted uranium ammunition as part of their standard? Yeah, like, you know, but yeah, she looks like an absolute empress, just like imperiously just blowing cars up and throwing people through windows. Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, once you get over, I mean, the main issue is always going to be like the squick of you know, the fact that our villains are incest cat demon vampires. And like that scene, there's a scene like early on where they try this, where they play seduce each other, and it's so freaking uncomfortable. But yeah, I mean, honestly, it's not a great film, but you know, it's entertaining and it doesn't overstay its welcome.
That's true.
Because I feel like if this had another like 20 minutes on it, it would be unbearable. But because it's 90, it's like, okay.
Okay, thank you, Will. Wendy, had you seen this before?
I had not.
What'd you think?
I don't remember this one. And, you know, it came out in the early 90s when I was really still very deep in my Stephen King phase. So I probably would not have appreciated this. I think I still don't appreciate it, maybe. But it does have a lot of really, really ridiculous things in it. The whole end battle scene is just amazing. Like from once Alice Krieger goes full on Terminator, which is a great expression, like through the end is just nonstop fun. So I did really enjoy that. And then that whole fire scene at the end where everything is on fire. We have a man on fire stumbling around. We have the exploding cop cars. We have her just burning up from the inside because of the cat scratches and bites. That was all just fantastic. That was worth the price of admission, which I guess was £1.26. but you know, the Stephen King, you know, I love Stephen King. I grew up on Stephen King. The Stephen King works of in this era just are not his best work. And you know, we'll mention this quick. It's really upsetting. The incest stuff is really, really upsetting. It's not played as abuse, which is what incest is. It's just played as this weird, loving relationship. And it's very uncomfortable. But it does have a man on fire stumbling around. And that does trump a lot of sins.
Okay. Thank you very much. So I had seen this before. In my head, I would have sworn blind that this was a TV movie. Like, I remembered this as being a TV movie. Clearly, it wasn't. If just for the mouth on the sheriff's deputy alone. Clovis's person. But it definitely has TV movie energy in a big way, which is not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing, but it absolutely does. And it was basically exactly the movie I remembered it being. You know, it is a Stephen King product from the early 1990s, which is kind of when nobody was saying no to Stephen King. and you can take that or leave that. As Wendy said, it was not his best work. Like, that era was not when he was coming up with his best stuff. But, you know, if you like Stephen King, then the stuff you like about Stephen King is in this movie in spades. It's big and it's over the top and it's kind of dumb. And, you know, he's less worried about, it's not trying to scare you. Like, this movie's not trying to scare you. There is frequently weird sex shit in a lot of his stuff around this time. This movie is no exception, to the point that you kind of sometimes have to ask, who is this for? I don't get the feeling like this is supposed to be sexy. I get the feeling this is supposed to just be an example of why these two were so upsetting. And, you know, well done. Well done, movie. Because I know, you know, Wendy, you bounced really, really hard off of the movie when that stuff was going on. I personally just was like, okay, so let me get this straight. Brian Krause needs to kill people, and then he transfers their energy to his mom by having sex with her. who is maybe. This for? Like, what is, like, I don't get it. But like you said, Dave, it's a big, dumb movie, and it's a lot of fun. When it's fun, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know? No movie with Glenn Shaddix is all bad.
Yeah.
You know, just like, oh, we have Shaddix. We have Shaddix.
We guarantee to make our money back, lads. We got Shaddix.
That's right.
I mean, the film did make its money back.
It did.
Because they had Shaddix.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this movie made its money back because this is the epitome of a 1990s movie, because it's Friday night, you're at the movie theater, it's only $5. What's playing next? Oh, yeah. It's Sleepwalkers. Okay, we'll go see that. You know, that aspect of the movies just isn't a thing anymore.
Yeah, that's very true.
But this is back when you could just go to the movies with no idea of what you were going to go see. You would just see whatever was on, whatever was showing next, and you'd probably be fine because it was only going to be $5. Imagine Amick.
Yeah.
I really thought she was really good.
Oh, yeah.
And this was a time it really seemed like things were going to happen for her around this time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because I mean, like, yeah, she did. This is post Twin Peaks, isn't it?
This is like right after Twin Peaks, yeah.
Yeah. She's really good. Like, she'd have made a very good kind of horror icon accent, you know. Like she makes a very good kind of final girl in this, you know. She's sweet, but like, she's also kind of capable of handling herself. Like, she manages to fend off Brian Krause with nothing but a corkscrew. I've always found her to be somebody who's got a lot of screen presence, a lot of charisma about her. And yeah, it was just kind of a shame that I understand she has like a pretty good career these days and she's been in all sorts of things. But yeah, like you say, you kind of felt that she kind of deserved to be a bigger deal.
Like, she was on the cusp of becoming a bigger deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, she had like a bunch of things that, you know, kind of were working for her, but then they just dried up. And then, you know, the bright side is like, she was consistently one of the most entertaining parts of Riverdale.
And sort of in this, I think she's one of the reasons that the film is kind of elevated above kind of what's on the page. Because it's a fairly thankless role in terms of basically just being the bait for the monster. But she, she's got a lot of charm in it. Like, when you first see her and she's dancing around to the music on her Walkman, and yeah, when she's kind of like hanging around with her friends in class and stuff, it's all very good. Like, the weird thing is, like, they make her family very weird. Like, there seems to be a lot of detail about kind of how to take rubbings in this film, to the point where they start talking about techniques of using stick or powder.
These movies don't get to 91 minutes by themselves, Dave.
I feel like somebody's wife has a hobby.
Yeah.
And they just randomly cast Ferris Bueller's parents as her parents.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't think that was random, but I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, the scene where she's like, when, you know, Brian Krause is in her room and she's just sort of stealthily trying to hide her underwear.
Yeah.
Was actually really funny and very cute, I thought.
I agree.
Like she had this very awkward teenager aspect to her. Even though, again, this is one of those towns where, you know, the high school graduating class are all 27 years old. She had that high school energy about her that I thought that you don't really see in movies very often. Like, that's an aspect that you forget about. And I think that they brought it across really well in this.
Yeah. And I mean, Brian Krause, for no matter what else you can say about him, he's creepy in this. Like for the moment you see him on screen, there is obviously something off about this guy. I mean, mainly partly because the first time you see him, he's carving letters into his arm. But but sort of all the way through, like, even when he's kind of at school, he's trying to fit in as a student. He's very clearly doesn't belong there, you know. And but it's kind of subtle because sort of by rights he is somebody that should be cool. He's, you know, he's a good looking guy, he's got a nice car, he appears to be quite charming, and yet there's something off about him that kind of, you know, sets off people's radar. And yeah. In a way, it's kind of a weird role. And I think like any actor would sort of struggle to do any more with it than Bryan Krause managed to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's like a point, I feel like, there's a certain point in the film where he's trying to play himself as being like conflicted over like trying to murder Tanya. And then he just goes full on slasher villain.
Yeah, basically once he decides he's going to get it done, then yeah, he's a quipping slasher villain. He plays dead, comes back up, got blood all over him. He's got kind of one-liners. I mean, I did quite enjoy the kill where the deputy gets taken out with his own pencil. Paul Blunt, when he's getting back up again, he's just sort of like, oh, what? Like, something's wrong, but I can't work out what it is.
Yeah, he was good, the deputy. I thought he was a lot of fun.
Yeah, he was great.
Yeah. It's just kind of ridiculous that, like, we need to get a cat in this at some point in order to show the effect that cats have on them. So, naturally, this is a member of the law enforcement who's allowed to just take his cat with him to work.
Yeah, in a movie about immortal, incestuous cat demons, the part that was unbelievable to me was that the deputy drove around with a cat in his patrol car.
Yeah. Maybe it's like an emotional support thing. Like, you know, it's like, this is my emotional support cat, you're not allowed to ask me about it.
Watching this movie, I was taken with just how rare it is in movies for cats to just be like unequivocally good, like,
yeah,
good guys.
I mean, cats are assholes. As someone who's had cats her whole life, cats are assholes.
And if I've learned one thing from watching like the works of Stephen King likes cats.
Mm-hmm.
You will never find a bad cat in a Stephen King work.
And you've like, what is it? Cat's Eye, like Cat's the Hero.
Yeah, that's, I mean, hell, I was almost going, when Dave brought this, I was almost going to suggest, hey, what about Cat's Eye for the other part of the picture? But that might have been a little too on the nose.
I don't know, that might have been fun.
But when we watched it for the podcast, a friend of ours came over, we introduced him to it as well. And one of the things he said he was most impressed with is the kind of literal herding of cats. Mm-hmm. The fact they've got so many cats on the set and they appear to be all just behaving themselves in the city where they need to sit. And yeah. You know, like it's rare in a film that you'll have that many actual cats on a set. And it's because, you know, cats are traditionally difficult to wrangle and train, but they seem to have got some good cats.
Well, I think when you have that many, you can get specialty cats. Like at one point I was impressed that they were all just like sitting in the yard being still. And those are other cats that are really, really good at staying when they're told to stay or eating whatever treat is hidden underneath them, or they're somehow secured to that area.
Yeah.
Whereas the attack cats, like, that's a whole different skill.
Yeah. And there were clearly stunned cats.
I think, I feel like the attack cats would be easier to cast.
Yeah, I think that's just a cat. I think that's just a cat.
Again, cats my whole life. Cats are assholes, man.
Yeah. There was probably somebody whose job on set it was to just kind of like yeet cats at people.
Now all I can think of is that the person working off stage is the like crazy cat lady from The Simpsons.
Yes.
Oh God.
So there's a core memory I have of being scared to the death of like the TV ad they had for this, because part of the TV ad is the scene where Bryan Krause is like in the car and sees the cat and he transforms into the demon thing.
Yeah.
And so when I was actually waiting for that scene when I'm watching this, and then I didn't know to realize, oh, he's also going to randomly turn into a baby head. Okay. That was weird.
Yep.
there's weird choices in this film. And I think Danny, you pointed this out. Like, morph technology is new, and they've got the software for it.
Yeah, this is like that early 90s, that year in the early 90s when morphing was brand fucking new. It was super expensive, and everybody was so hyped about it. And it just looks like garbage.
The sleepwalkers with their amazing car transformation powers.
Yep.
How the fuck is that a power he has? Like, I feel like they kind of explained it like they have some kind of ability to glamour. Mm-hmm. Because they do that thing where they dim, and I feel like that's kind of a glamour. But a whole fucking car? No. I don't know. That's not a thing.
And I do love the bit when he first turns the car invisible that Clovis can still see it. Like, Clovis is like, dude, he's right there. Like, what are you doing?
Clovis really is the hero.
I'm looking right at him.
Oh, Clovis.
You just have the cat just... We're pointing, by the way.
And, you know, in terms of cat casting, Clovis is, that's a cat with some charisma. Mm-hmm.
Clovis is played by Sparks.
Yeah.
Yeah, Clovis got his own, credit.
Yeah.
Like, he's actually listed on the wiki page.
Yeah. Well, I'm assuming he's a SAG member. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a cat that's got, like, presence.
Mm-hmm.
And just like when Clovis decides he's had enough, like, yeah, the first time he kind of steps into action, he's like, he's kind of expecting his human to kind of deal with the situation. But once the human's down, he's like, oi! What the hell, man? Although I did say that sort of after, because he crawls up onto the body of the deputy and sort of sits down, we were saying that. Yeah, that's not an affection thing. That's just kind of like, that's the cat claiming it's meat. Yeah, this is mine. Nobody else. Well, I get to eat this.
And honestly, though, any movie where somebody uses an ear of corn as a murder weapon.
Yes, that was fantastic.
I laughed my ass off. Just to see the body on the ground with the ear of corn sticking out.
It's the few kind of little bits of corn around him as well that just kind of makes it.
Yeah.
And yeah, sort of Ron Perlman just turning up in this for a cup of coffee. Mm. It's just sort of like, yeah, brilliant, marvellous.
Yeah, because he'd done Beauty and the Beast is before this, right?
Yeah, that would have been about 89, I think.
Yeah, that was like a late 80s into the early 90s thing. Like, Ron Perlman is a known actor at this point.
Okay. I mean, he's not Ron Perlman yet, but he's, yeah.
But he's basically doing a lot of Jean-Pierre Jeunet and Guillermo del Toro films at this point, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, has he done The City of Lost Children by then?
Oh, possibly.
Not quite yet. Not quite.
I think he would have done Kronos by then.
Yeah.
He says hastily Googling.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, right? Not yeah, quite. City of Lost Children was 95.
That's such a great movie. But yeah, Beauty and the Beast started in 87.
Okay. I did have to take a moment and go, is that Mark Hamill?
Yeah.
Like, 40-something Mark Hamill is not as immediately recognizable as 20-something Mark Hamill or 60-something Mark Hamill.
Yeah, I mean, like, go and watch... Well, don't watch the remake of Children of the Damned, but if you ever do, I mean, you barely even know, so he plays the priest in it.
Mm-hmm. So, Slipstream. That's what he'd be watching, Slipstream.
Yeah.
Which I've never seen, actually, but it's very much the poster child for Mark Hamill's wilderness years.
Yeah, he was not getting a lot of work at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm thankful, you know, voice acting came naturally to him. Mm-hmm. And also, this is all, I think the couple years before was Flash.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And Wing Commander was still on the horizon.
Yes. But yeah, no, it always takes me like a little, I always forget he's in it right at the start. And then like, yeah, like you say, you get that 2 seconds. It's like, is that Mark Hamill? Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Excellent. And of course they do the cat jump scare. I mean, like, mm-hmm. you kind of have to in this film, don't you? Given how prominent cats are, you have to do the cat suddenly jumping out of somewhere jump scare.
Yeah. Although I will say that scene with all the cats kind of hanging in front of the house, that genuinely was like, oh, no, don't like that.
Yeah.
Don't like that.
As a cat owner. It's like, no, Misty, don't look. Your people come good in the end, but don't look at the stars.
Still, like, they're able to, like, just hang all those cats around there when they're living in Bodega Bay or wherever the fuck they were at the beginning. And then once they get to to Indiana, suddenly their ability to catch cats has just gone to incompetence. Because there's literally all those cats are constantly prowling around the house. And it's like, are cats just attracted to them because they want to murder them? Or do they just decide, okay, we can only harvest life force from virginal girls who live near cats?
the cats of that town are just very protective of their people. Just like, no, we know what you are. Get out of here.
We got the memo.
I mean, like the first time the film gets properly kind of over the top horror is when poor Glenn Shaddix gets properly carved up. But yeah, the reason he's like, there's that whole scene where he talks about like a box having four sides, and then like Brian Krause says, oh, a box has actually got six sides. And apparently from then on, he's obsessed with him. Like the next scene, like after the class ends, he's staring at like, box has four sides. And then he starts digging up dirt on him and starts researching him, but all because he told him how many sides a box has. And then when he's got running away with one hand going like, I'm sorry, it's like, maybe a box does have six sides, I take it all back.
And maybe this is just me, but if I found out that, you know, this, my mortal enemy, the kid who says, who told me a box has six sides, came from a town that doesn't exist in Ohio, maybe I don't try to sexually blackmail him, and maybe I go and tell the police or something. I don't know.
The high school administration would be the appropriate place to take that information. But I'm sorry, like, if you all don't think this is realistic, you have never corrected a teacher in high school.
Yeah, there's a not zero amount of that in actual high school teachers that is not incorrect. Maybe it's taken up to the you know, the Mrs. White level of Stephen King characters. Oh,
yeah.
But
it's amped up, but yeah, they do not like to be corrected.
Totally fair.
So also, this wouldn't be a Stephen King movie if it didn't have a healthy amount of pre-Beatles 1960 songs on the soundtrack.
Yes.
It's so great.
Yeah. I think, generally speaking, the music in this film is fantastic. Like, the score's pretty good as well.
Score's really good, yeah. But like, to this day, I can't, like, when I first saw this movie in 1990, whatever I saw it, to this day, this is the movie I think of whenever I hear Sleepwalk. Like, I cannot hear Sleepwalk without thinking of this movie. I've never been able to.
Yeah, no, I mean, that'll do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the theme from this movie is so good.
It is.
Well, I'm getting a sense that we've probably reached our natural end on this one.
I think you're probably right. I think you're probably right.
Yeah, I mean, only other interesting fact, the director of this also wrote Hocus Pocus.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, they did.
Excellent.
Yeah, Stephen King said, get me the Critters 2 guy.
To be fair, he did like a bunch of episodes of Amazing Stories also.
Oh, that was a fun show.
And She-Wolf of London.
That was not.
Across the centuries comes this exciting story of a modern girl cursed by an ancient legend. A
legend of the cat people. Women whose kiss means death, whose love turns them into vicious, snarling beasts of prey.
Twice I've been followed by something that was not human, something that attempted to take my life. I believe that was the cat form of Irena.
Why should she wish to harm you?
Because I'm in love with her husband. It shut, Bell. Just a minute ago, it was open.
It's locked.
Leave us, Irena!
And next up, we kept to our werecat theme with 1942's Cat People, the original. Thought about the 80s one, but it was a little too expensive. Whereas it turns out, being made by RKO pretty much automatically makes it a B-movie, regardless of anything else.
There is something reassuring about seeing the RKO logo at the start of a 40s film, isn't there?
Yeah. Like, you have that brief glimmer of, maybe this is going to be Citizen Kane, and then it's not.
It's much more magnificent Amberson's energy.
Yeah. We'll use some of the sets. Does anyone want to take a crack at the plot? I can do it if no. No? Okay. That's fair. Okay. So, Irena is a kind of a new to America immigrant. She's hanging out at the Central Park Zoo, and she meets an engineer named Oliver Reed, who is apparently not has to this point not been Bill Sykes yet. She invites him up to her place for tea.
Yay, the Hays Code.
Yeah. Oh, this movie just completely gives the fingers of the Hays Code from start to finish, and I love it for it. She has a statue of a kind of a knight on horseback, and he's got a cat hip deep in his sword. And Irena says, "Oh, this is King John, and he drove all the cat people out of Serbia." Or some shit. And so, like, the next day, he buys her a cat. He buys her a kitten. Says, last night was cool. Here's a lifetime commitment.
But remember how you said that cats were evil and they disturbed you? I brought you a cat.
Yeah. and it does not like Irena. The cat just hisses and snarls at it. So they go to exchange it, and they exchange it for a canary, which dies because it's afraid of her. You know, all the animals just go completely bug-fucking nuts as soon as they go up in there. So, you know, Irena actually has to go outside, and she's afraid that if she gets too aroused, she'll turn into a cat and kill everybody. And Oliver's like, all right, let's get married.
even though apparently we've never kissed.
We've never kissed. We met yesterday. I know there's a war on, but come on. You know, they have their after-wedding dinner at a Serbian restaurant where a woman just kind of walks up to her and starts speaking Serbian at her and leaves.
And is never seen again.
Never seen again. So they never consummate the marriage. Irena is too terrified of turning into a cat person. So Oliver's like, okay, you know what? After a while, I'm going to need you to see a psychiatrist because this is this is too much. And the psychiatrist's like, yeah, you're crazy. This is not a thing. You're not going to turn into a cat person. You know, Oliver, not completely unexpectedly, his office wife is kind of starting to look pretty good. Alice, and they start to kind of hang out more and more. You know, they don't do anything, but they're definitely hanging out more. And Alice is like, oh, I love you. And that's basically it. At that point, Irena's done. Irena sees them together. She follows Alice home. We start to see, we hear a lot of weird sounds. And Irena kind of is like under the lamppost and is going to start running and running and running, like under the lamppost, dark to light. And it's kind of creepy. And all of a sudden, the bus pulls up with its air brakes and squeaks the shit out of everybody. Irena and whoever's watching.
Apparently, I was reading that was the first recorded jump scare.
Yeah, the first recorded jump scare was this movie. There's a lot of dead sheep at the zoo. The groundskeeper kind of looks around and he sees like a bit like a large cat's paw prints. And they sort of turn into a lady wearing high heeled shoe prints. Irena has a dream of her psychiatrist dressed up as King John. And here's the key. And she steals the key to the panther's cage at the zoo because the zookeeper's kind of an idiot. Keeps leaving it out. The three of them, Irena, Oliver, and Alice, they all go to the museum. And the two of them ignore Irena the entire time. So she's done. She follows Alice back to her house, and Alice is lives in a hotel or an apartment building, but there's a swimming pool in the basement. So, she hears a lot of animal sounds and she's freaked out. And all of a sudden Irena turns the light on and says, oh, it's just me. What are you worried about? Stay the fuck away from my husband. Alice's bathrobe is just completely torn up, but she goes back to her psychiatrist and they have a good talk and she decides she's not afraid. She's not going to be afraid anymore. She's not worried about turning into the panther lady. And Oliver says, no, you know what? I'm sorry. I really am, but I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I'm gonna give you a divorce and Alice and I are going to be in love and go off and do our thing. Basically, at that point, we're at the end of the movie. Oliver goes to Alice. The panther comes to, a panther kills Judd, the psycho. There's so much going on. There's, Irena goes to see her psychiatrist. He comes on to her. She turns into a panther and kills him. Off screen. They go to the zoo. I don't even know what the fuck happens next. Irena.
Irena lets the, she kind of stalks Oliver and mm-hmm. Alice at their work as a panther, which he manages to fend her off with a T-square.
Yeah.
And then she goes to the zoo, unleashes the panther, which then kills her, and then the panther gets run over by a taxi cab. And then everyone goes home.
Yeah.
She never lied to us.
Turns out she was a werecat off screen.
Yeah.
So, why did I pick this one? Honestly, it's kind of a semi-classic. It's one of those movies that either people really, really love or really, really don't. I know that like Roger Ebert thought this was like one of the best movies ever made. And it's got a lot going for it, but we'll kind of talk it out as we go. Had anybody seen this before?
I had.
You had? Okay. So Will, when did you see this before?
I want to say it was last year.
Oh, okay.
Basically, I was trying to find a horror movie to watch before a Halloween party, and I didn't have that long. And I was like, okay, I need to find something that's like an hour and a half. And I'm like, okay, this works.
Mm-hmm. Well, what'd you think?
I mean, honestly, yeah, there's a reason. There, it does have a lot of interesting things going for it. I mean, it uses lighting really well the entire film. Mm-hmm. There's the fact that, yeah, like you said, they basically just kind of thumb their nose at the Hays Code the entire time. Mm-hmm. And then you also have the fact that every single character in this movie, with the exception of Irena, is a shit heel and deserves to get eaten by a cat person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, She has a shitty husband, so maybe she deserves to be able to eat her psychiatrist as a treat.
Yeah.
Because the psychiatrist yes. literally comes onto her, and I'm like, okay, you deserve this.
Yeah.
It's kind of out of nowhere, too.
Yep.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, like, I honestly, like, enjoy the film. There are moments where I'm like, okay, do they really need to this or that? Like, there's a little too much of the stalking of Alice. Like, the first time was great, and then the swimming pool happens. And I feel like the swimming pool was just there as an excuse to get her in a bathing suit. Mm-hmm. And then there is also the fact we never see the cat. Which, you know, budget, but still.
Yeah, that's a thing. How about you, Wendy? Tell me what you were thinking.
Well, I think that Cat People is the story of a young woman fleeing, you know, generational trauma and her bad history in Serbia, who comes to America for a fresh start, and minding her own fucking business at the zoo. She's pursued by a fuckboy. And after she shares her deep fear of cats with him, he thinks it would be funny to buy her a fucking cat. He then pursues her, woos her, marries to her, and then complains about her to his office wife. The two of them conspire to get her to see a therapist, decide that they're actually in love and fuck her, and they're going to have her put away. So they set her up by luring her back to the apartment with the therapist who's going to do paperwork to put her away in an asylum. She manages to evade them, and then her therapist sexually assaults her. She defends herself, runs away, giving in to her true power, only to be hit by a fucking car. It's not a horror movie, it's a tragedy.
Amen.
Also, that was the holy T-square of Antioch. And that was why and that was why it was so effective at warding her off.
Yeah, I was half expecting sort of when he was trying to ward her off with the T-square, just like she suddenly pats his and like, that's a square not a cross, motherfucker, and just takes him out.
Yeah, so that was the fucking movie that I watched.
Okay. And yourself, Dave?
Yeah, like everyone else, very much Team Elena all the Irena all the way. Yeah. She basically does nothing wrong. She's minding her own business. This guy, she writes the guy over, but she's always clear about her issues with intimacy, regardless of what they may be based in. She makes that very clear to him. After like a day, he declares his love for her and says they're going to get married. And then sort of when they get married, and even though she's described all of this, and like, even though they state they've never kissed, but apparently he's fine with all of this, and then starts going, oh no, these are just silly stories, and like, you know, you should see a psychiatrist, and I'm going to start hanging out with my work wife now, and like, we're going to go to the museum and send you away so we can spend all of our time looking at ships. It's just kind of like, yes, everybody in this film deserves to get eaten by a cat person. And what kind of psychiatrist walks everywhere with a sword stick?
The kind that has to defend himself against his patients a lot, I'm imagining.
Well, yeah, defending himself against all the malpractice he's committing.
Yeah.
The shitty therapist chosen by the work wife.
Yeah. Yeah. They're like, basically, just like, fuck everyone in this movie who's not a writer.
Yeah.
It was very clearly said, she's not interested in that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing, like, she, like we said, like, she very clearly explains what her issues are from the get-go. Yeah, like they said at the end, she never lied to you. But, like, even if, like, I get the feeling that, like, had there been sort of, like, a loving and caring exchange of affection, she wouldn't have turned into a cat person. But because they were weird about it, cat people are plenty.
I feel like she very clearly defined her boundaries.
Absolutely.
She experiences romantic attraction and she's not interested in sex. And yep. He knew her boundaries and he chose to ignore them. And he should have been the one who died in the park.
Oh, yeah. No, I fully wanted, like, this to be a film where she kills everybody who's wronged her. And we were cheering her on.
Maybe the problem is that because they use the sets for the Magnificent Ambersons, that no one is ever allowed to have a comeuppance. That is a deep cut film history joke, people.
You hear me? No comeuppance!
The sets are gorgeous, for the record.
The sets are.
Oh, they absolutely are.
Like, I want to live in an apartment that has, like, that up that staircase up to the second floor.
It looks like the set from The Fisher King, which is so fucking beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, to kind of get into my own thoughts, no disagreements with anybody about the relative merits of the characters in this movie. But I overall liked this movie, if for no other reason than it's just so beautiful. It is an absolutely gorgeously shot movie. And the set design is one. The set design, where there is set design, is wonderful. Irena's apartment, again, it was a leftover from the Magnificent Ambersons, and they use it remarkably well. Absolutely beautiful piece of work. And Oliver's office, they kind of use this big empty space, and they use it super, super interestingly. It's just, it's shot so well. Like, this is made the year after Citizen Kane, and you can tell that the cinematographer has taken some notes. It's beautifully, beautifully made movie. Reason, yes.
No, I was going to say, this is Val Lewton, isn't it, the director?
Yes, it is. Yeah, Val Lewton is the producer.
Ah, right, okay.
Jacques Tourneur was the director.
Okay.
But, I mean, Val Lewton, this was kind of his stock in trade, was this kind of movie. You know, like, I guess Arkea wanted to, like, Universal was having a lot of success still with their monster films at this point. Like, the ones that we think of as the classics are kind of behind them, but they're still making really fun, successful, you know, Frankenstein versus the Wolfman type movies.
Sure.
And Arkea says, well, let's get in on that. And Val Lewton's like, well, okay, but I want to do something way different from what they're doing. And this is kind of the sort of thing that he was coming up with, was let's make it more about suspense. Let's make it more about atmosphere. Because we don't got no money. Like, we've got a panther for a day. Let's, let's make the best use of the panther as we can. Everything else will happen off screen or basically in animation. But it works, because if they had tried to do, like, if they tried to turn Irena into a panther, it would have looked ridiculous. It would have completely ruined all of the atmosphere that they had come up with for this movie.
They couldn't have done that. No,
they couldn't have done that. And they didn't try. And that's the smartest thing they could have done.
It would have been Manimal.
It would have been Manimal. It absolutely would have. So, you know, I can say, oh man, it sucks that we don't get any on-screen transformations or, like, basically much of the cat. But I this was the correct choice.
Yeah. And there's someone well-schooled in the world of Manimal.
Yes.
And seeing how they kind of like covered the gaps and the infamous paw on a stick that was used as
like, if you're not a 9-year-old boy, nothing in Manimal could have added anything to this movie. Now, as somebody who was a 9-year-old boy when Manimal was out, I can tell you that was the shit.
This is the most anyone has talked about Manimal in probably a decade.
I refer you to my podcast, which is my other podcast, which is less than 10 years old, I hope.
Yeah. Fair.
Yeah, there was a very not zero amount of Manimal on that show.
Yeah. I thought the act who played Irena was fantastic. I thought she was really good.
Yeah.
She's kind of got that kind of, she got that real combination of vulnerability but with edge as well, because obviously, you know, she's called upon to be both, and I think she does a really good job. Yeah, she's a lot of the film, she's this, you know, kind of portrayed as like a naive wallflower, you know, and then sort of towards the end, like, yeah, she has some menace to her without being over the top. It's more just how she kind of stands and how she phrases things and stuff, rather than it being kind of moustache twirling the evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like they're going for kind of a Larry Talbot thing with her, where she's like, don't do the thing that's going to make me turn into the monster. I'd really rather not turn into the monster if that's okay with you. And then she turns into the monster and kills everybody.
Yeah.
Or a person, anyway.
Yeah.
But, like, that's part of... It's one of the things that's really interesting to me is, again, watching this, like, from the very beginning, I'm like, this is a movie that clearly knows that the Hays Code is paying no attention to it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we get, obviously, you know, it's very, very hinted that, you know, they went up for sex, even though they expressly say that they didn't. They do all the movie code for sex. Multiple times in this movie. But at the end, we kind of have this dilemma where Irena's the monster who killed somebody, so she has to die at the end.
Yeah.
But also, Oliver is the unfaithful husband, and Alice is the other woman. They're supposed to get their comeuppance at the end.
Yeah.
You can't have it both ways.
Well, you can.
Good. That could have happened. They could have all died. That could have
easily happened. Mm-hmm. Like they get ripped apart by Urania and an animal control shows up and just deals with it, you know? It could have been the end of an American Werewolf at London, basically.
I was going to say a David Naughton situation.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I don't know if this is a good time to bring up the sequel, but...
Yeah, go for it.
So the sequel to this movie takes place like 6 or 7 years later when they live in upstate New York with their daughter...
Oh, they're back, are they? The pair of them.
Oh, yeah. A lot of the cast comes back. Including
good. I'm really interested to see how their lives are getting on.
Well, not...
Assholes.
Not well.
Well, I mean, in the case that, you know, their daughter plays with her imaginary friend who's actually the ghost of Irena.
Yeah, get him, Irena! Come on!
Yeah, and then the creepy cat lady is also in the film as a completely different character who is the daughter of a senile old woman that is obsessed with with Oliver and Alice's daughter. But gets saved by the ghost of Irena. Yeah. Like, it's also technically a Christmas movie.
Oh, I love that.
Go on.
I think our Christmas episode is starting to take shape.
I mean, you double that with Gremlins, and there you go.
Well, that definitely solves our Joe Dante problem.
You're welcome.
Having seen this, I am curious to see the 80s remake now, see what they do.
The 80s remake is not terrible. It's very of its time.
Right.
It was directed by Paul Schrader, who's probably better known as a writer. He wrote Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
And it's basically an excuse to get Natasha Kinski out of her clothes as much as possible.
Yeah.
Also an Ed O'Toole, if that's of interest to you.
Yeah, and we're talking about the Squick in the last movie. This also has Squick.
Right.
Because her brother really wants to have sex with her.
Right. But is the plot pretty much the same?
It's the same.
Other than kind of like, yeah.
It's the same.
I take it Ed O'Toole's like the Alice.
Ed O'Toole is Alice.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's in the pool. That's how we get our rating for right. Annette O'Toole.
Right.
Yeah. It's not terrible, but it was much more of a much more budgeted movie. I don't know if I would call it like an A budget, but it had some money put behind it. And it's a decent, it looks like a decently successful movie as well. So
yeah.
It didn't really fit this podcast.
No, that's fair, but like having seen this, I'd be, you know, cute. Out of curiosity, if nothing else, what an 80s take on this would be, which I'm assuming is going to be, like, as you described, a bit more exploitative.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, nobody in this movie really is a good person, at least among our main characters, except for Arena. But yeah, I just, because it's just so well made, I just find myself enjoying it, even if I don't like anybody in it. You know, if that makes any sense at all.
I do love the first shot of the kind of shipping office. There's the kind of very kind of 1940s kind of guy in suit pants smoking their heads off while in the middle of just like puffing on a cigarette, walking through the workplace, going, "Ah, yes, do that. Bolt that thing to this thing and do that and draw this."
The Commodore. He's a great character.
Yeah, yeah, he's good. Also, they weren't credited, but Doc. Dave, you've been having yourself a Batman 66 rewatch. Doc is Alan Napier.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I didn't spot it at all. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, he was like 20 years younger.
Yeah, but
25. But yeah.
Alfred. Okay. Jeez.
But yeah, the Commodore was a lot.
I guess I didn't recognize him because he wasn't like a scrawny old man in a Batman costume.
Oh, I love that show so much.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh.
So also in this film is Teresa Harris, who plays Minnie, the waitress at the diner.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Teresa worked for RKO and frequently played maids. And this was actually a great part for her because Minnie is fun and funny and a little sarcastic.
Yeah.
And she's a delight. She's in a lot of those old films, including one of my favorite old RKO movies, The Gold Diggers of 1933, mm-hmm. which I've made Danny watch at least three times.
Oh, that's fantastic. I love that movie. That's a fantastic movie. We have
I really hope somebody did buy her gumbo at some point, because by the sound of it, it's probably amazing.
Yeah, she was really fun. For her 5 minutes of total screen time, she was really, really fun.
Though I will say I was confused because the Serbian place that they eat at the wedding reception looks exactly like the diner. Mm-hmm. So I kept on thinking, they found the Serbian place. Now that's the only place they eat now.
It's an RKO radio picture.
Yeah. And that's when I realized, it's the same set. They're just shooting it from a different angle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that set looked like a set. Like of all the sets in this movie, that's the one that looked like basically just, let's just pull some tables in here and get this over with. Like, that wall was practically theatrical flats.
One little bit of weird confusion I had also is when they were talking about how King John of Serbia drove out like the Mamelukes, I misheard it as Marmaduke.
Yes, we all did, I think.
And I was like, yep, of course Marmaduke's gonna bring evil.
Yeah. He won't get out of your chair.
He thinks he's people.
I mean, that's what happened. I mean, listen, Marmaduke is a devil dog sent to torture Adolf Hitler in hell.
Mm-hmm. I think like for the moment he goes into her flat, sort of like Oliver's just like, she explains what the statue is, and it's something from a her country's heritage. Oh, why do you have it in your house? And she kind of quite rightly points out, like, you've seen pictures of, like, George Washington and stuff, and just, it's your country's heritage. Like, why are you being such a dick about this?
This is what I'm saying.
And, like, when she says, it's King John, and he's like, what, of England? He's like, no, of Serbia.
You idiot.
like that would have been fine if he had a statue of England's King John. That would have made perfect sense.
My personal theory is that Oliver lived in like a shitty one room apartment where he had to share a bathroom with like 12 other people, and then he meets this girl and he's just like, I'm gonna marry you so I can get your apartment.
I mean, it is an amazing apartment, to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, he's living in what, like a cold water flat with like one set of navy blue sheets.
That's been washed exactly one time, and that one time was 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And basically he's too scared to take the sheets off because he's terrified of what he'll find underneath.
So Oliver is just basically using Arena to be upwardly mobile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly what he's doing. She's a very successful fashion sketch artist, I guess. But she's like making it on her own in the city. Like, look at that gorgeous place she lives in. She's clearly doing just fine without this guy.
Yeah.
And he's just doing engineering work instead of, you know, doing his civic duty in World War II, I guess.
Yeah, that's something else to point out. This movie, like, World War II was actively happening when this movie came out. And the movie doesn't really acknowledge that. I mean, we get that Irina left Eastern Europe under circumstances that we're not talking about.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, as you say, if this, like, what's going on? Why isn't Oliver doing where he's supposed to be?
He sucks.
He has flat feet.
Mm. Bone spurs?
Mm-hmm.
That's right, I said it. Come at me. So are we good here?
I believe we are.
I think we're good here. Well,
I think we're cat peopled out.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Well, join us next time. Join us at Christmas when we probably find out what Oliver and the other one, Alistair, have been up to this whole time. Until then, thank you very much for being here. Go to bed.
Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show was presented by Wendy Abramo, Will Ackerman, Dave Probert, and DJ Toland. I knew a girl named Irina in school. She wasn't a werecat, but she did start a rumor that I was born with a cloaca. The school actually held a candy drive to help. I didn't go to my reunion.
I'm so sorry.
For people listening, this is much more funny because you can, from what we can see, you're just casually just kind of like throwing off these quick messages in the middle of doing something else. Like, it's like just the casual listening to War from London while she's in the middle of doing something that's clearly funny.
She's just
it wouldn't be as funny if you wasn't doing it while doing something else.
Look, I'm done talking about sleepwalkers, and the candy is not going to crush itself.
God.
Well, honestly, that this whole discussion has been worth it for this moment.